Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to a press conference by the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Given we have a lot of participants who have dialed in, I'll quickly run through some of the housekeeping arrangements. All participants on the phone are in a listen-only mode. There'll be remarks by the Governor followed by a question and answer session. I'll hand the session to the moderator to facilitate questions over the phone. Please limit yourself to one question. I'd now like to hand the press conference over to Mr. Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia.
Thank you, Judy, and good afternoon. As you would know, the Reserve Bank Board met this morning. We decided on a comprehensive package of further measures to support the Australian economy as it recovers from COVID-19. Given the significance of this package, I wanted to explain in person what we're doing, why we're doing it, and to answer your questions. At its core, today's decision reflects the Reserve Bank Board's commitment to do what we reasonably can with the tools that we have to support the recovery of the Australian economy. The Board views addressing the high rate of unemployment as a national priority, and it wants to do what it can do to support job creation. Importantly, today's decision complements government efforts to support the Australian economy and to lower unemployment. When the virus first hit our shores, economic policy quickly turned to building a bridge to the recovery. That was the right strategy, and this bridge has made a major difference to people's lives. It's helped many households and businesses get through a very difficult period. This bridge has been constructed through a collective effort by the governments in Australia, the Reserve Bank, Australia's financial regulators, and Australia's financial institutions. For the Reserve Bank's part, we've kept borrowing costs low, we've kept the financial system very liquid, and we've supported the supply of credit to the economy. This broad economic policy response and Australia's success on the health front have meant that the Australian economy is in better shape than many other countries. While Australians have experienced a severe recession, it hasn't been as bad as was earlier feared, and it hasn't been as bad as experienced in many other countries. In light of this experience, we've recently updated the economic outlook, and we're going to publish full details of this on Friday in the Statement of Monetary Policy. These updated forecasts will contain an upgrade to the near-term economic outlook, although there are a number of factors weighing on the medium-term outlook, including lower population growth. On balance, both the recent household spending data and the employment data have been a little stronger than we were expecting. It now appears probable that GDP increased solidly in the September quarter despite the lockdown in Victoria, and growth over the year to June 21 is expected to be close to 6% compared to an expectation of 4% when we last reviewed the forecast 3 months ago. The fiscal support, including through the recent budget, has played an important role here. The unemployment rate is also now expected to peak at a lower rate than previously, a little below 8%, rather than the 10% we expected 3 months ago. This upgrade to the near-term outlook is clearly welcome news. At the same time, though, we need to recognise that the pandemic has inflicted significant damage on the Australian economy. It will take time to repair that damage, and it's highly likely that the recovery will be uneven, it will be bumpy, and it will be drawn out. In particular, we face the prospect of a long period of higher unemployment and underemployment than we've become used to over recent times. In the RBA's central scenario, job creation is slow over coming months, and the unemployment rate is still around 6% at the end of 2022. One consequence of this is that wages growth and inflation are both likely to stay very low over the next few years. In each of the next 2 years, we're expecting annual wage growth of less than 2%, and inflation in underlying terms expected to be just 1% next year and 1.5% in 2022. Given this outlook, the Board judged that it was appropriate to take further steps today to support the economy. Unemployment is a major economic and social problem, and it damages the fabric of our society. So it's important that it's addressed. The board recognises that in the context of the pandemic, the responsibility for job creation falls mainly on the shoulders of business and of government. But the Reserve Bank can and will make a contribution too. Today's policy package does this, and it builds on the contributions from our earlier policy packages in the year. Today's package has three elements. These are first, a reduction in the cash rate target, the three-year yield target, and the interest rate on new drawings under the Term Funding Facility to just 10 basis points from the current 25 basis points. Second, a reduction in the interest rate on exchange settlement balances to zero from the current 10 basis points. And third, the introduction of a program of government bond purchases. In particular, we're intending to buy $100 billion of government bonds over the next 6 months, purchasing bonds issued by the Australian government and by the states and territories. Together, these three elements represent a very significant package. The lower interest rates and our plan to buy $100 billion of government bonds over the next 6 months will help people get back into jobs, and it will support the recovery of the Australian economy. The package combines the price-based target at the shorter part of the yield curve with a quantity target at the longer part of the yield curve. In doing so, it will lower the whole structure of interest rates in Australia. This lower structure of interest rates will help to support the economy through the normal transition channels, including lower borrowing costs, a lower exchange rate than otherwise, and higher asset prices and stronger balance sheets. To be clear, the inflation target remains the cornerstone of Australia's monetary policy framework. Even so, the priority over the next few years is jobs, with inflation risks remaining low. The RBA has a strong and broad legislative mandate for price stability, full employment, and the economic welfare of the Australian people. Today's decision reflects that broad mandate. The board expects that this new lower level of interest rates will be in place for an extended period. The board will not increase the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the target range. It's not enough for inflation to be forecast or expected to be in the target range. For inflation to be sustainably within the target range, wage growth will have to be materially higher than it currently is. This will require a lower rate of unemployment and a return to a tight labour market. On the current outlook, this looks to be some way off. Given this, the board is not expecting to increase the cash rate for at least 3 years. And it remains the case that prior to any increase in the cash rate target, the board intends to remove the three-year yield target. I'd now like to provide some more details on the bond purchase program. At the start, it's important to point out that all purchases will be made in the secondary market through an open auction process. The RBA will not be buying bonds directly from the government. We plan to hold auctions three times a week on Mondays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, with the first auction to be held this Thursday. On Mondays and Thursdays, we plan to buy bonds issued by the Australian government, and on Wednesdays, we plan to purchase bonds issued by the states and territories. We will focus on buying bonds with maturities of around 5 to 10 years, but we may also buy bonds outside this range depending upon market circumstances. To assist with the smooth running of the auctions, we plan to buy Australian government securities with the 5 to 7 year maturities on Mondays and Australian government securities with 7 to 10 year maturities on Thursdays. The semis we plan to alternate weekly between the 5 to 7 and the 7 to 10 year maturities. We're purchasing fixed rate nominal bonds only, as these are the benchmark fixed income securities in Australia and they underpin the pricing of many other assets. Inflation index bonds are not part of this program. The initial auctions for Australian government securities will be for around $2 billion, and the initial auctions for semis will be around $1 billion. This means that we expect to purchase around $5 billion of bonds each week. We will closely monitor the impact of these purchases on market functioning, and we are prepared to adjust the size and the timing of these auctions if necessary. If the size of these initial auctions is maintained, 80% of the bonds purchases would be Australian government securities and 20% would be securities issued by the states and territories. In allocating the bond purchases across the various states and territories, we'll be guided by the stock of debt outstanding and by relative market pricing. These bond purchases mean that the RBA is now conducting quantitative easing, or QE, similar to that of any other central banks. I want to point out, though, that there has already been a very substantial increase in the size of the Reserve Bank's balance sheet as a result of our earlier measures. Once these additional bond purchases are completed mid-next year, our balance sheet would have nearly tripled since the beginning of this year. I also want to point out that this bond purchase program is separate from any bond purchases that we undertake to support the three-year yield target. We remain committed to buying bonds in whatever quantities needed to support the three-year yield target. Any bonds purchased in support of that target would be separate from the $100 billion program we're announcing today. I would now like to address four specific questions that I know that some people might have. And I'll then answer questions more broadly. The four specific questions are, why make this change today? Why are we moving now? The second question, is the RBA now financing the government? The third is, why have you elected to have both a price and a quantity target? And the fourth question that I'd like to address is, with interest rates so low, is the RBA now out of firepower? So the first question is, why make this change today? Why move now? It's an understandable question, especially given that we're easing monetary policy further today at the same time as we're upgrading the forecast for the near-term outlook for the economy. Apart from the general case for further monetary easing that I've already spoken about, there are a couple of other factors that have influenced the timing. The first is that over recent months, we have learnt about the pandemic and its economic impact. As the months have passed, it's become increasingly apparent that there are likely to be long-lasting effects from the pandemic, in particular, higher unemployment. While the outlook does remain highly uncertain, we do have a somewhat clearer picture of the future state of the labour market. A sharp bounce back in jobs is unlikely, and it will take time to return to where we were before the pandemic. And we've responded to this clearer picture today. The second factor influencing the timing is that monetary easing is likely to get more traction today than would have been the case when there were widespread restrictions in place. In earlier months, the usual transmission mechanisms weren't working as normal, and the challenges facing the country were best addressed by other policy tools. As restrictions have been eased and people have more opportunities to spend, our judgment is that further monetary easing now provides additional support to the other policies, including the fiscal initiatives and the RBA's earlier monetary policy easing. In reaching today's decision, the board also considered the effects on medium-term financial and macro stability, as well as the impact of lower interest rates on savers. The board recognises that low interest rates can encourage some additional risk-taking as investors search for yield. It also recognises that low deposit rates can create difficulties for some people, particularly those relying on interest income. And these issues will need to be closely watched over the months ahead. But the board judged that the bigger risk at the moment was the threat to our economy and to balance sheets from an extended period of high unemployment. Today's decision will lessen that risk. The second question, is the RBA now financing the government? The answer here is clear and simple. It's no, we're not. Today's decision does not change the long-standing separation of monetary policy and fiscal financing in Australia. The RBA is not financing government spending. I want to highlight the important distinction between providing finance and affecting the cost of that finance. The RBA is not providing finance to the government, but our actions are lowering the cost of government finance. I should point out, though, that our actions are also lowering the cost of finance for all other borrowers in Australia, whether they're a household buying their first home or businesses wanting to expand and employ people. This lower cost of finance for everybody is supporting the recovery from the pandemic. It's also important to point out that the bonds purchased by the RBA will have to be repaid by governments at maturity. They'll have to be repaid in exactly the same way as they would if the bonds were held by others. And the same is true for the ongoing coupon payments on these bonds. The fact that the RBA is holding some bonds makes no difference at all to the financial obligations of the government, other than through a lower cost of finance. The Australian government and the states and territories continue to fund themselves in the market, as they should. Raising funds in the market is an important discipline, and movements in market prices can contain valuable information. Recent bond auctions have been heavily oversubscribed, even though the size of these auctions have been much larger than in the past. There is strong demand by domestic and international investors for bonds issued by the Australian government and by the states and territories, and they're able to issue these securities at low rates, and I expect that this will continue. The third question is, why have both a price and a quantity target? As part of the RBA's March package, we announced a price target for the yield on three-year Australian government bonds, rather than a quantity of bonds to purchase. We viewed the yield target as a more direct way of achieving our objective of low funding costs. The target also reinforced our forward guidance regarding the cash rate. Given that we expect the cash rate to remain low for years, we judged it was appropriate to target a three-year yield and stand behind that target with our balance sheet. These arguments for a yield target remain valid, and we're continuing with the three-year yield target. We considered targeting a longer yield at our meeting today, say 5 years, but we decided against that. This was on the basis that the yield target is most effective when it's consistent with our forward guidance regarding the cash rate. As I said earlier, we expect the cash rate to be its current level for at least the next 3 years. But beyond that, we have less confidence. I certainly hope that the economy will be sufficiently strong sometime over the next 5 years to warrant an increase in the cash rate. So 3 years, not 5 years, is the appropriate maturity for the yield target. Today's decision supplements this price target with a quantity target further out along the yield curve. This quantity target is similar to the approach adopted by many other central banks who've responded to the pandemic with government bond buying programs. The evidence is that these programs have lowered government bond yields in these countries. And one result of this is that Australia has had higher long-term bond yields than elsewhere, even though the setting of the short-term policy rate has been similar across countries. These higher bond yields have added to the attractiveness of Australian dollar assets, and this has put some upward pressure on our exchange rate. There's also been an accumulation of evidence that central bank balance sheet expansion has a stimulatory effect beyond that resulting from lower bond yields. When the central bank buys assets off the private sector, investors in the private sector adjust their portfolios. They buy different assets with the proceeds of their bond sales. This portfolio rebalancing can affect the price of other assets. It can affect international capital flows and it can affect the exchange rate. Given these considerations, the board judged that it was now appropriate to combine the three-year yield target with QE further out along the yield curve. My final question, is the RBA now out of firepower? Short answer here is again, no, we're not. The Reserve Bank is not out of firepower. We have additional monetary policy options, and we are prepared to use those if the circumstances require it. In terms of interest rates, I think we have gone as far as it makes sense to do so in the current environment. There's been no change to the board's view that there's little to be gained from lowering the policy rate into negative territory. While a negative rate might lead to a helpful depreciation of the Australian dollar, it could impair the supply of credit to the economy, and it could lead some people to save more rather than send more, so be counterproductive. Given this assessment, the board continues to view a negative policy rate in Australia as extraordinarily unlikely. But monetary policy is now more than just about short-term interest rates. We've returned to a world in which quantities matter too. In this world, it's certainly possible for us to increase the size of our bond purchases. Given this, we will continue to closely monitor the economic situation and the impact of our purchases on market functioning. If we need to do more, we can and we will. The RBA also has a range of tools to support the proper functioning of markets and to address market dysfunction if that were to occur. These tools include further liquidity provision, asset purchases, and transactions in the foreign exchange market. So it would be incorrect to conclude that we're out of firepower. If we need to do more, we can and we will. So that brings me to the end of the four questions I posed. I'm now happy to answer any other questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now go to questions. Please limit yourself to one question each. If you wish to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star two. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Matt Cranston from the Australian Financial Review. Please go ahead.
Governor, thanks for taking questions. Two very quick ones. If Victoria hadn't gone into lockdown, do you think you'd need to take these measures? And secondly, your expectations for the banks. I know obviously you'd like them to just pass on cheaper funding, but could you be a little bit more precise in what you expect the banks to do following this unprecedented reduction in funding costs?
On the question of Victoria, it's clear that the lockdown in Victoria has detracted from GDP growth. Our estimate is that it's taken off between 1.5% and 2% of GDP. So that's in the current quarter. But our decision to implement this policy package today is really about the outlook for unemployment over the next 2 years. The developments in Victoria haven't helped that, but I think we still would have been making this adjustment in policy even if we hadn't had the lockdown in Victoria, because the outlook for the labour market, I think, requires further action. You know, we can do better than having the unemployment rate sit in the sixes and sevens for a few years. And if we can do better than that, the Reserve Bank's board's view is that we should try to get there. The second question was about pass-through. I would expect and hope that these interest rate reductions get passed through to all borrowers. We've got to recognise, though, that the way that pass-through is occurring in the Australian financial system has changed over time. It used to be by banks lowering their standard variable rate and all rates would adjust immediately. But what's happened over the course of the past year is that many banks have left their standard variable rates unchanged, and the pass-through is occurring through borrowers renegotiating with their bank at a lower rate, or in some cases switching to a bank who's prepared to offer them a lower rate. So that seems the way to be the way that pass-through is working. I would expect that that to continue to be the case. I think the best outcome would be for standard variable rates to be lowered, but if that doesn't occur, I'm confident that there'll be pass-through occurring through people renegotiating and switching. And as I have been doing for years, I encourage everybody to go and ask their bank for a better deal. If they don't give you a better deal after today's decision, ask them, and if they don't give it to you, switch to a bank that will.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Faraz Fayed from Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Lowe. This is actually Josh Williamson here at Citigroup. My question will be very brief. You previously stated that the effective lower bound on the policy rate was 25 basis points. Does the shift today to 10 basis points imply that that is the new effective lower bound, or have you got a lower bound in mind?
I think 10 basis points is pretty low. There's not much room between 0 and 10, is there? I think it's appropriate to keep a margin between kind of the cash rate target and the rate we pay on exchange settlement balances. So as I said in my prepared remarks, I think we are at the effective lower bound now. We have very little appetite, essentially no appetite, to go into negative territory. Judgment is that that would not be helpful. I don't think kind of moving the cash rate target from 8 to 7 basis points makes any sense either. So I think we've done as much as we can on interest rates, and the focus now is really on the quantity of asset purchases.
Thank you. Your next question is from Ricardo Gonclave from SBS. Please go ahead.
G'day, Governor. Was this package of measures unanimously supported by all board members?
I don't think it's appropriate to talk about the kind of the views of individual board members, but I think the short answer is there's a very broad consensus that this is the right way to go. I think we're all concerned about the outlook for the jobs and the labour market, and we recognise that this package of measures will in the end help support spending in the economy, and it will create more jobs and more people have better lives because of that. And we're united in that conviction.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Swati Pandey from Reuters. Please go ahead.
Hello, Governor. My question is about your 5 to 10 year bond purchase. Is there a level you would like in your view to fall through? And is there a ceiling to the amount of bonds you are willing to buy as a percentage of total debt outstanding?
I didn't catch the first part of the question. Is there a level of the yield that we...
Is there a level you would like 10 year yield to fall to? Like how far you would like it to come down?
We're not targeting the 5 or the 10 year yield. I don't think it's appropriate to do that in Australia. So we haven't got a target for that. I'd note that just before the press conference, the 10 year yield was down in the mid 70s. That's now 7 or 8 basis points below where the US is. It's a bit higher than 10 year yields in Canada. It would be helpful if they came down a little further. Whether that happens or not will be determined by the market and the market's response to our purchases. But we don't have a target there. In terms of our bond purchases, a share of the stock of debt outstanding, when we complete the $100 billion, we'll own around 15% of government bonds on issue. That sounds like a large number. In the US, though, the Federal Reserve owns a bit more than 20% of the US bonds on issue. I think in Europe, the ECB owns around 30%. I think in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand owns nearly 40% of the government bonds on issue. So if we need to do more, we have the scope to do that, and we'll continue to evaluate the case for that over the next year.
Your next question comes from Stephen Helmerich from CBA. Please go ahead.
Hello, Governor. Thanks for taking questions. I'm wondering what set of criteria will you use to decide if the increased bond purchase program ends after 6 months or it should continue after that?
Well, it's a bit early. We haven't even started buying the bonds yet, so what happens at the end of the program? But at a high level, I think there are two factors we'll be considering. The first is the impact of our purchase on market functioning. It's important that these markets continue to function well. We want to see a high level of liquidity in them, and we want to see the pricing process continue to work effectively. So the markets have to keep on working well, which I expect they will. The more fundamental consideration, though, is the outlook for jobs and employment and ultimately inflation. We will continue to look at our projections for the unemployment rate, whether people are getting back into jobs and what other policy efforts there are to support employment. So we'll, at each of our meetings over the next 6 months, we'll be looking at whether there's a case to extend this, but we have to see how these bond purchases go in the market first of all.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Ben Butler from The Guardian. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much, Governor. I thought I'd try my luck with two brief ones as well. Firstly, this is widely seen out there this afternoon as the Reserve Bank saying essentially that the government has not done enough or is not doing enough in terms of fiscal stimulus. So I was wondering if you could respond to that in a way that's a little bit more expansive than no, that's not what we're saying. And secondly, I was wondering if you could provide for the layperson an explanation of why it is that the Reserve Bank won't run out of firepower.
On the first question, this is certainly not a judgment on the government's fiscal policy. I think the government strategy is the right one through the combination of income transfers, incentives for the private sector and direct job creation. That together is going to help people get into jobs, and what we're doing is supporting and supplementing the government's efforts. So it would be completely incorrect to draw the conclusion that this is a judgment on the government's fiscal strategy. I think the government's on the right track, and we want to be supportive of their efforts to get the unemployment rate down. The second question was explain why there isn't a limit to what we can do. As I said before, other central banks have bought a lot more government securities than the Reserve Bank is currently planning to do. So we know from their experience that central banks, through the process of money creation, can buy government securities. And the only limits on that are the proper functioning of these markets. There's an economic question to answer as well. Is it effective in stimulating economic activity? But because of the nature of a central bank, we can buy assets. If we decide we want to do that, we can effectively create money by crediting the banking system's accounts that they have with us, and we can effectively do that without limit. And there's ultimately a limit because of the credibility of the process could come under question. But we know the limit is much further north than where we currently are or are planning to be.
Your next question comes from Shane Wright from The Age. Please go ahead.
Dr. Lowe, before the virus, the bank had low inflation, above Nauru unemployment, and a relatively high underemployment. Now, even with these forecasts you announced today, you've got inflation well short of the target out to 2022 and unemployment at 6% at the end of 2022. It just seems inevitable you're going to have to go further and keep rates lower for longer. Your idea that you hope to see interest rates going up sometimes in the next 5 years seems a little forlorn. Is that fair?
I don't think it's forlorn. I'm more optimistic than you are. I would hope that we're not permanently in this world of zero interest rates. We're here largely because at the moment the appetite to save globally is very high, understandably, and the desire to invest is very low, understandably because of all the uncertainty. So when a lot of people want to save and not many people want to invest, savers, through the interest rate, get low returns. I don't think this is a permanent state of affairs. Sometime in the next 5 years, it's hard to predict exactly when, but sometime in the next 5 years, I'd expect people being prepared to spend more and save a bit less. And I do think the desire to invest by businesses will return. We can't predict exactly when and how fast it returns. But as that saving investment recalibrates, then interest rates will rise. It's hard to know exactly when, but I think we've got to be sufficiently optimistic that this recalibration will occur sometime over the next 5 years. Australia still has incredibly strong fundamentals. The medium-term investment outlook is positive. We have tremendous opportunities across a whole range of industries. Population growth has slowed now, but I think it will pick up again. And there are a lot of productivity improvements that are coming out of the pandemic. We're changing the way that we work and businesses operate. There's the whole digital revolution, which I think will present new investment opportunities. So I'm confident that sometime in the next 5 years, these fundamentals will reassert themselves, businesses will want to invest again, and people won't want to save at the rate they've been saving at recently. And as they do that, the economy will strengthen and interest rates will normalise. I don't think that's a forlorn hope at all. I think it's quite realistic.
Thank you. Your next question is from Prashant Nuwana from TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Governor. Just a question on the bank's intended purchases of government securities. So in the notes that were attached, you stated that the focus will be on bonds with a residual maturity of around 5 to 10 years, but they may include bonds outside of this range. So the question essentially is, where is this 10-year cutoff? Is it to the date, the year, or is it the 10-year bond basket?
Our intention is for it to be the 10-year bond basket. And the same for the 5 years, and it'll move for as the months move, but at the moment I think there are probably bonds that are kind of a bit less than 5 years and other bonds with a maturity of a bit more than 10 years that would be in those baskets, and they'll move as the months pass. So we're not applying a strict cutoff of exactly 10 years to the day. It's really the bond baskets. As I said in my prepared remarks, we haven't ruled out buying bonds outside this range either if market conditions warrant it. We're expecting to be able to confine the bond purchases to those that are within the roughly 5 to 10 year range, but if we need to buy other bonds, we will. And of course, if we need to buy bonds to defend the 3-year yield target, we will do that as well, and that will be completely separate from the QE program.
Thank you. Your next question is from Patrick Comans from The Australian. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Lowe. I had a question around savers. I mean, what do you say to savers and particularly retirees who are relying on income from their deposits to fund their retirement? They're essentially collateral damage of aggressive monetary policy easing, are they not?
What I'd say to them is we understand their pain. We discussed this extensively at our board meeting today. I know personally because many of the people write to me explaining the difficult circumstances that they're in, and I acknowledge the effect of monetary easing falls very unevenly across the community. The people who are relying on interest income as their main source of income bear a heavy share of the burden here. And I understand why they would be unhappy, and I think it's regrettable we find ourselves in this situation. As I said before, the underlying driver of this is there are a lot of people around the world who want to save, and not many people want to invest. So if you save a lot but people don't want to use your money to invest, the harsh and unfortunate reality here is you're going to get a low return on your saving. So the solution here is to get businesses to invest and to have other individuals want to use their income to spend rather than to save. If we can do that, then, as I said before, I'm confident we can get back to a world where savers can get decent rates of return. I think the other thing I would say to savers is there's an issue about the collective good here. I think lower interest rates will help support spending, and ultimately that will create jobs. So the broader community will benefit from today's decision, but the effects are felt unevenly across the community. And the solution to that is stronger growth, more investment, and confidence so people save less and spend more. And I would like to see that just as much as the savers.
Thank you. Your next question is from Jonathan Shapiro from the AFR. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much, Governor. The Reserve Bank's been reluctant or hesitant to go down the path of quantitative easing all the way up until around August, September. My question is, what worries you now that you are entering this new monetary policy paradigm? What are your concerns in this new phase of monetary policy?
I don't have particular concerns about the new phase of monetary policy. Our major priority is to do what we can to get people back into jobs. I'm concerned that we could go a few years with many tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people not having the employment that they should have. And we know that that's destructive for the economy, but it's also very damaging in people's lives and their prospects. So that's my major concern. I hope that today's, and I expect that today's efforts will help there. In terms of the specifics about our monetary policy decision, I worry about the effect on savers, as I just said. In the past, I would have worried about the effect on the housing market. I'm not particularly concerned about that at the moment. In the past, I've been worried that lower interest rates would encourage people to borrow more and push up housing prices. We're going to have to watch that carefully, but I think the dynamics of the housing market have changed. Population growth is slower. Investors are seeing rents fall at the fastest rate that we've ever seen. The vacancy rate's quite high. So at the moment, I'm not particularly worried about causing excesses in the housing market, although I have to keep that under review. My main worry is not enough people having the jobs they deserve.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Tapas Strickland from NAB. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Governor Lowe. I had a question around the forecasts and whether today's policy package is incorporated into the forecast profile, and if not, an updated set of forecasts see unemployment and inflation going towards where you would consider full employment and towards the middle of the inflation target? Thank you.
Today's forecasts and the ones we will release on Friday, which are the same numbers, contain today's policy decision. And the reality we face is even with today's policy decision, inflation's too low and the unemployment rate's too high. If we hadn't moved today, the situation would be even more difficult with an even higher expected unemployment rate and lower inflation.
Thank you. Your next question comes from John Kehoe from the Australian Financial Review. Please go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Lowe. I'm curious to know why the $100 billion figure was chosen for QE. Was there some back-of-the-envelope calculation you were working on the potential impact on long-term bond yields and the Australian dollar? And also, how will you decide how to apportion the 20% of purchases that are going to be dedicated to state government semi-securities? I mean, will it be done on their population, their GDP, their debt to GDP, or their debt to GDP? How will you work out that?
Why the $100 billion? It's a very good question. One advantage we have here of doing this a bit later than other central banks, we've got to observe what others have done. I've chaired a study at the Bank for International Settlements which looked at the effectiveness of some of these monetary policy measures, and we've been in close contact with our colleagues elsewhere. While the estimates vary across the various studies, it's reasonably clear that a bond purchase program that's equivalent to 5% of GDP, which is what $100 billion here is, has noticeable and meaningful effects on long-term bond yields, and it can have an effect on the exchange rate. So the international experience suggests that, so 5% of GDP was the benchmark we were using, and that turns out to be around $100 billion. If it turns out that that's the wrong number, we're prepared to adjust over time, and we'll keep this under review at our meetings next year. In terms of deciding how to allocate the semis purchases across the various jurisdictions, we're going to use their relative shares in total debt outstanding. We've looked at various other rules. You could use population or state final demand. It doesn't really make that much difference in the overall scheme of things. So the easiest benchmark to use is their share in debt outstanding. And partly that's driven by the fact that we don't want to cause market dysfunction in any of these markets. So if we buy a similar share of debt outstanding in each of them, we minimise the chance of causing market dislocation. Because it's really important that these markets still work well, that there's liquidity in them, and that they send the relative price signals that they've done for years. Expecting that that will continue to be the case, and the best way of doing it is to buy a roughly equal share of their debt outstanding. If we'd used a different rule, we'd come up with a very similar number, though.
Thank you. Your next question is from Elise Morgan from ABC. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Governor. First question is that you addressed why the RBA didn't go earlier with this, but not why you haven't waited and go later, given that you've talked up growth and job creation and Victoria is now opening up. And a quick second question, you've previously said that you would not do QE, you've now done it. You've also ruled out previously negative rates. Why should we believe you now that you won't do negative rates?
Why not wait? We discussed this at our meeting today, what the case for waiting, and the conclusion we drew is that the outlook for the economy over the next 2 years was sufficiently concerning, particularly around the labour market, that we should act today. I mean, you can always wait and hopefully things will turn out to be better, but as we've gone through recent months, it seemed pretty clear that we face a number of years of quite high unemployment. Our judgment is that would still look to be the case in December and in February when we met, and there was not much point in waiting. We'd better get on with it. We wanted to do whatever we can do to support jobs and get people back in earning income in the labour market. And the faster we get on with that, the better, particularly given that the economy is now opening up, and I think we will get some traction, whereas a number of months ago, as I said, we didn't think we'd get any traction. Your second question was that we've done things that we said we wouldn't do. I've been careful in the past not to say that we wouldn't do these things. I said it's unlikely, we're not inclined to do it. And I think absent a global pandemic, we wouldn't be going down this route. Now, we've been hit by the biggest economic shock in well over 100 years. We've seen many countries around the world output fall by 20%. It's staggering. Here in Australia, we've had a very big decline in output, hours worked falling by 10%. So I think in face with that shock, we all have to go back and look at all the tools we have, and that's what we've done. We haven't been limited by our previous communication. Well, I've had tried to be careful in the past not to rule out things. And on negative interest rates, saying they're extraordinarily unlikely. And that remains my view. I'm not saying this will never happen. And if we saw the biggest central banks in the world all go negative, then we would have to consider that. But I don't think the biggest central banks in the world are going to go negative. And I don't think we're going to go negative as well, but you know, I'm not completely and irrevocably ruling out. That would be foolish, but I think it's extraordinarily unlikely. And other than the effect on the exchange rate, I think it would be unhelpful. But you know, faced with the biggest economic shock in 100 years, we, like everybody else, has had to adapt. And we're keeping in focus the need to get people back into jobs and earning incomes again. That's our number one priority.
Thank you. Your next question is from Sophia Rodriguez from Central Bank Intel. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Lo. Given the number, record number of monetary policy decisions today, your ultra dovish forward guidance, and then we top it up by saying, if we need to do more, we can and we will. Is this the same as ECB saying we will do whatever it takes? Can that be the headline of my next article?
I wouldn't characterize it like that. When the ECB said it would do whatever it takes, it was speaking in terms of keeping the euro together, keeping the European project alive. We don't face that type of issue here. What we will do is to do everything that we can reasonably do to help the national effort to get the unemployment rate down, people back into jobs and earning incomes. We will learn over coming months the effects of what we've done to date and whether there's a strong case to do more. If there's a case to do more, then we will do it. I think it would be it's too early, obviously, to pre-commit to doing more because we don't know what the next months are going to give us, and there's also the possibility of further government measures. As I've been saying for some time, I would like to see the state, at least some of the state governments, have further spending, particularly on infrastructure and programs that would directly create jobs. I know a number of the state governments have their budgets coming up. I think our decision to buy their bonds hopefully gives them some encouragement to do some extra job spending, some spending which will create jobs. But we will keep reviewing the situation over coming months, and if we need to do more, as I said, we have the capability to do it, and we will do it if we think it can help.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Suleen Ong from RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Governor. You said that you won't be buying any bonds that have recently been tapped or newly issued. Can you give us a sense of what time frame that is? Does that mean you won't buy anything that's been tapped or issued in the last week, 2 weeks? What kind of time frame?
Well, we haven't got a hard and fast rule there, but my thinking at the moment is that if a bond has been tapped or issued in the last week, we will steer clear of that bond. We're doing that partly because we want to avoid any possibility that people see us as financing the government. I think if the government issues a bond that week and we buy at the same time, people could incorrectly assume we were financing the government. So we're very keen to keep away from any bond line that's just been tapped or issued. So I think a week is an appropriate distance, but we'll see both the market reaction and market depth around those securities.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Jessica Irvine from the Sydney Morning Herald. Please go ahead.
Hi, Phil. Is the recession over?
No, the recession isn't over, and I'd have to say my colleague, Guy DeBell, did not say the recession was over as well. So there was a lot of misreporting on that issue. What Guy said and what I've said today, we expect GDP growth to be positive in the September quarter, and I'm hoping it's solidly positive. But a lot of people are out of work. A lot of businesses have closed, and a lot of people don't have their normal hours worked. The level of output is, I think, right through this year and next year going to be below where it was at the end of last year. So on any reasonable definition, we're in a recession, except for the technical definition of two quarters of negative growth. So the economy is growing, which is good. We will be coming out of recession, but No. We are clearly in recession. With so many people out of job and businesses closed, I don't know how anyone concluded that we're not in recession. Other than someone wants to take a very technical, narrow definition, which is not what we're inclined to do.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Vesna Poljak from AFR. Please go ahead.
Governor, do you worry that lower yields will make it harder to complete the fundraising task necessary to fund the deficit?
No, not at all. I think there's still very strong demand for Australian government securities. The recent bond auctions have been heavily oversubscribed. Both domestic and international investors find Australian government securities very attractive. Got still relatively high yield compared to many other countries, even though they're lower as a result of our decision, it's still relatively high. Australia is an incredibly well-run country. The level of public debt is still low. The credit ratings are very high, and investors find both federal government and state and territory government securities very attractive, and I don't think that's going to change. Now, the Australian dollar investments, the bonds issued by the Australian government, are very attractive. In a world of great uncertainty, Australian economy is doing well, public debt's low, the country's well run, and we have tremendous opportunities in the future. So I would expect there's still to be strong demand for these securities.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Michael Heath from Bloomberg. Please go ahead.
Hi, Phil. Just wondering if you could confirm that the basis of this program seems to be to bring down the Australian dollar, or at least take some of the drive to appreciate out of it. So is that correct? And the other one is, if the opportunity opens up, would you be prepared to intervene, given the currency does seem to be the main factor you're looking at now?
Well, I wouldn't conclude the currency is the main factor. It's one of the factors. As I said in the introductory remarks, there are three transmission channels through which this package helps. The first is lower lending rates. That'll gradually give people more cash flow, and with that extra cash flow, they'll spend a bit more, and maybe some firms will do a bit more investment. So that remains an important channel. Another channel, obviously, is less upward pressure, or maybe even downward pressure on the exchange rate, so that will help our exporters. And the third channel is higher asset prices. I think the fact that we've got lower interest rates and the portfolio substitutions that come from our asset purchases will lead to some other asset prices being higher, and that will strengthen some balance sheets. The most obvious example of that is the housing market, where if housing prices are rising rather than falling, the people's balance sheets are better and they might spend a bit more. So the combination of those three things, the cash flow effect, the lower exchange rate, and the stronger balance sheets, will all over time, not instantaneously, but over time, that'll lead to more spending in the economy and there'll be more jobs. So it's incorrect, I think, to conclude that this is mainly about the exchange rate. It's really about all those transmission channels. Would we intervene in the foreign exchange market? Our position on that has been well spelled out and hasn't changed for a long period of time. The only cases where we would intervene is if the market is dysfunctional, which it's not, and the exchange rate's a long way away from where one can justify it based on fundamentals, which it isn't. The fact that we would like a lower currency to help with job creation and boost the inflation rate isn't enough to get us to intervene, because we're realistic about what can be achieved. Intervening when the market's dysfunctional or you're a long way from fundamentals, I think you can be successful. But if the market is broadly in line with fundamentals, intervening isn't likely to give you any durable effect. We might like the currency to be lower, but we've got to be realistic about what's achievable. In today's package, will at the margin lead to a lower currency than we otherwise would have had, and we've seen the Australian dollar depreciate over the past month as people have realised that we might have a policy package. So it's not really just about the exchange rates. Cash flow and balance sheets are equally important. Thank you.